I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a man who almost made the electric car a part of our lives. It was over 35 years ago when Wayne Goldman devised and built his first one, and he discovered then that without the roar of the slant six, no one paid any attention to him on the road.
One of the problems is you couldn't get people to move. If you were in traffic, you didn't want to blow the horn, so you're going, excuse me, excuse me.
Wayne Goldman did well with his battery-powered car. He found investors. He took the car into production. He got big companies like Exxon and Avis and the post office interested. But he learned back in the mid-70s that people weren't ready for an efficient little city machine, a commuter car. That then and now, we also want the long-distance machine to take us to the Grand Canyon in July. Even today, says Wayne Goldman, that's still not possible. And I'll talk with him right after the news. There's a man in Vermont who still wonders, what if? What if the rest of us had been a little more open to the idea of a car that plugged in and ran on batteries? Wayne Goldman designed and built those cars back in the early 70s. He sold them to the post office and to airlines, and Exxon was among the initial investors. He even set up dealerships. And just when it seemed like it might go, Exxon pulled the plug.
At the last minute, Exxon said, we no longer want to be in this business. We had $1 million in orders on the books, and we lost that. I think it was around 75 at the time, and we couldn't turn it around.
These days, Chevrolet and other car makers are scrambling all over each other trying to get back into the electric car market. Wayne Goldman has a warning for them. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
I saw the signs on the gas pumps this weekend. $3.25, even more for high test. So here's an insider's tip. Watch the news out of London and Geneva this week. One high-tech company and an as-yet-unnamed major automaker are rolling out their version of the electric car. And if you're thinking, wait a minute, isn't this an idea I've heard about a few times already? You are absolutely right. In fact, the same question was asked in a documentary film called Who Killed the Electric Car?
In 1996, electric cars began to appear on roads all over California. They were quiet and fast, produced no exhaust, and ran without gasoline. 10 years later, these futuristic cars were almost entirely gone. What happened? Why should we be haunted by the ghost of the electric car?
Wayne Goldman is not haunted by that ghost. He still has enough parts in his garage to build you an electric car. Wayne is a reminder of how many chances we've all had to seize this technology. He was the engineering manager in a Boston firm. Wayne designed his first electric car 37 years ago.
I'm sitting at my desk and I'm reading Scientific American, and they were talking about having an event for clean air cars to go from Boston to California as part of a university test program and everything else.
What year is this?
I think that was 1970.
Okay.
So I went down to the president's office, and he had the VP of marketing there, and I said, I'm going to build an electric car and go cross country. Are you with me or against me? And the VP of marketing said, is he kidding? The president said, no, I don't think he is. I said, no, I'm not kidding. I'm going to make an electric car, and I'm going to drive it cross-country, with me or against me. He said, do me a favor. Do it at home. I said, will you pay for parts? He said, yes. I said, great. I went home and had always been a sports car buff. So I started thinking about electric cars and came up with a concept and fabricated all the mechanical parts in my garage. I think I cut 250 pieces of tubing with a hacksaw and welded them together. And we built an electric car.
Help me with an understanding of the technology here. You take it upon yourself to design and build an electric car. Are you working with a kind of prototype of the electric golf cart and making it, you know, bigger, longer, faster? What are you doing that's different?
No. First of all, I said, why is a gasoline car successful? And the reason why a gasoline car is successful is because on every street corner in America, there's a gas station. And if you didn't have a gas station, you couldn't go anywhere. So I used the same concept. I said, let's make an electric car where the batteries can be changed. So rather than tying the car up during the day, plugging it in and charging it for 8 hours, we'll have a battery exchange system. Change the battery pack in like 2 minutes and you're on your way again.
This is like I buy a new propane tank for my grill, for my barbecue, right? Just
exactly.
Take the old one, here's
exactly.
The new one. Why did this catch your imagination? Why were you even interested in this?
I told the company, the president, I said, look, we sell equipment to the forklift truck industry. Imagine what would happen if the electric vehicle was viable. That is a market for us far in excess of anything that we're doing right now. So why don't we pursue it and let's see what develops?
So it was a commercial idea. We might make a whole lot of money if we can design the successful electric car. It wasn't necessarily based in the early 70s on a fuel crisis or on a push for a greener earth. Is that fair?
Well, actually, that was about the time when people were talking about how do we clean up the environment around, because they wanted to pass the Clean Air Car Act, you know, where we start producing automobiles that would have catalytic converters that wouldn't be pumping out so much of the emissions. So this is around the same period.
Right. Okay. So that trend is beginning. You're just jumping a few years ahead.
Well, also, I thought that would be a fun project. So I had to come up with an argument to make it sound viable to the company.
Did you have all these tools yourself in your garage, or did you have
to go? Yes, I'm an incredible tinkerer. I have a complete shop at home. Plus the fact is the company said, don't do it at work because I would tie up the engineering department. But as we got into the project, they got all excited. Because one of the first things I did was to go out and find a co-sponsor. And since we had to go cross-country and we would have to carry extra batteries for this exchange process, I was going to need a chase vehicle and a truck. So I called Avis. Avis said, well, we're not interested in that type of thing. And I said, well, you should be. I think Hertz is interested. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I heard a rumor that Hertz was interested in renting electric cars in Washington. He said, well, now I'm interested.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Wayne Goldman's electric car would have to carry a lot of batteries, batteries that could weigh as much as 900 pounds. So he had to come up with a new design. Still, he says, it also had to be aerodynamic.
The first one looked like a race car. I didn't really have a major budget to build this car. So I contacted a company who made electric motors. I contacted some battery companies. GE gave me plastic panels, which I used to make the body. Steve McQueen was a sports car nut, and he had a company that made racing seats, and I got that from them. So the whole car sort of evolved around what I could obtain and then designing something that looked like a race car.
How did it look? I mean, did it look good?
Actually, it was amazing because we had made a few sketches of what we thought it was going to look like, and the end result was it did look like that.
Did you tart it up with racing stripes and paint?
I decided to use Lexan panels, polycarbonate panels. So they were like a 16th of an inch thick plastic panels that was clear. So in order to put markings on it, we had to use the stick-on type tape.
Yeah.
And so what we could do is silk screen the names and everything on. So we had all these panels mounted on the clear car, and you could sort of see around the lettering. It was actually a very effective way of making a low-cost battery powered car.
Do you remember the first time you backed it out of the driveway and actually took it out on the road?
Where the company was located was at the bottom of a big hill, and I found out later on that they were taking bets at work that the car would never go up the hill. And I think one guy in the shop had confidence, and he made a lot of money, and the car did go up the hill.
Was it struggling by the time it got to the top?
No, it worked right from the get-go.
How fast did this car go, Wayne?
We designed the car to go about 50 miles an hour, and the idea was to have a 50-mile range. But that was using an excessive amount of batteries for the volume of the car.
And this was all part of an effort to join this cross-country race that you read about in Scientific American. Did that ever happen? Did you go in the race?
Yes. The idea was to go from Boston, and we went up to Buffalo, up to Ann Arbor. Then we were supposed to go down to El Paso, Texas, and then over to Los Angeles. But it was not just for electric cars. It was for all types of vehicles. We had everything from gas turbine car. We had vehicles that were just modified to get better gas mileage, that type of thing.
What did they do? Did they close down the highway like they do now for a
running race? No, it wasn't closed down at all. They had provisions at some of the cities where there were battery chargers, that type of thing for the electric cars.
Now, you had planned yours to have this kind of replaceable battery pack. At this point, I suppose you're just charging it at night rather than...
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Did you win?
Actually, there was no winner. What we discovered when we got to Ann Arbor is that the event was scheduled to close like in, oh, I think 3 or 4 days. And I said, wait a minute, it's going to take us longer than that for the electric cars to get to L.A. And I said, look, we have driven to Ann Arbor. I think we proved that the vehicle works. To tell you the truth, I'd rather be there at the finish when they take the photographs, when they start shooting the movie and get the film footage. I'd rather be in on that. So at the end, we put the car on a trailer that we had behind the chase vehicle, and we brought it to L.A.
Nobody accused you of cheating, did they?
No, because that was perfectly legal. In fact, most of the electric cars had dropped out of the race, and everybody was towing their vehicles to California.
When Wayne got back from California, he set to work building more cars. Remember, this was back in the energy crisis of the early 70s, and people were interested in this. The cars caught on. In fact, interest came from some of the most unlikely angles.
As soon as I get this seat belt on...
All we do is turn the key and push it up for forward and back for reverse.
But I don't hear anything.
It's totally silent. You don't hear an electric car.
You mean it's on now?
It is on. Press that and we'll move backwards.
You know when Mr. Rogers is interested that there has to be something to it. And yet, even with that kind of attention, Wayne Goldman's car-making venture never really got going. And I'll get him to tell me why in just a moment. I think you'll find that this is a part of the story that really hasn't changed that much. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The price of oil has hit one more historic high, selling at over $103 a barrel. One of the story listeners, Heather from Elfland, North Carolina, wrote to tell me that she'd like to hear more about green technologies, about global warming and developing new energy and car alternatives. Well, we're on the case, Heather. Wayne Goldman's talking about his adventures with the electric car. And for people who embrace this kind of technology, the fact that it hasn't taken off is a big part of this story. Almost 30 years ago, Wayne Goldman's electric car was featured on the children's television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
There's a little car, big garage for a little car. But I wanted you to see this. This is a model of an electric car. That's the kind of a car that doesn't use any gasoline. It just has big batteries that make it go. I know some people who make real electric cars, big enough for people to ride in. I remember one day I was out jogging, and I decided to go to the garage where my friends were making those cars.
Turns out that was Wayne Goldman's garage. And Wayne met Fred Rogers by chance. Wayne had been giving a talk at a school on Nantucket Island, and Mr. Rogers was in the audience.
He had come over to the school and heard the talk, and then afterwards had come up to me and said, you know, what we'd like to do is come up to the Boston area and do a show. And I'll tell you, he was a fascinating character. He really was.
Wayne, when you were a little boy, were you interested in cars?
Anything with wheels.
Oh, really?
In fact, that's how we build the car. We take the frame, we attach the wheels and the springs that are used to support the car. And after we do that, then we put the batteries in the car. What we have instead of gas are batteries.
There are 18 batteries there.
That's right.
It was a funny way of doing journalism, but the funny thing is that when you look back on it, that's exactly what it was.
Oh, yeah. They had hired a film crew in the Boston area, and it was a rather cold, drizzly day, and we were outside, and we were doing all kinds of filming, and the cameraman said, "We have never seen anyone like this." He was so low-key, so adaptable. You couldn't break for lunch. Somebody gave him a granola bar, and he's going, "Boy, this is great."
Yeah, I really like this car.
Would you like to take it for a ride?
I'd like to try to drive it.
Fine. Why don't we get Paul? He can show you how. Paul?
Paul, would you show me how to drive this?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Great. Thank you very much, Wayne.
Thanks for stopping by.
Wish you well with your cars here.
Have a good ride.
Okay.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Wayne Goldman set himself up in business. He gathered together some influential investors. Exxon was one. And they went into production. Wayne smiles today when he hears the engineer's frustration over what a battery-powered car can do or can't do. See, that part of the story hasn't really changed. I asked Wayne about the novelty of the electric car back in the 70s, what it was like to drive one.
The strangest thing about driving an electric car is when you come to a red light, because you don't hear anything. And then you start to say, does the car still work? So you tap the accelerator slightly, and then you hear the clicking sound of the solenoid cutting in, and then you just hear this whirring sound. Driving on the highway, it was just fascinating.
Like being in a glider on a plane where all you hear
yes,
is the sound of the
yes,
wind going past.
And you don't hear any noises. So what happens? You start hearing noises you hadn't heard before. You'd hear the disc brakes, you know, starting to touch, that type of thing.
And what about people who were standing beside the car when you'd come up to a stop sign or driving away?
Well, one of the problems is you couldn't get people to move. If you were in traffic, you didn't want to blow the horn, so you're going, excuse me, nudging them out of the way.
All you needed was a big rubber bumper, and you could just gently push them out of
yeah,
the way.
Exactly.
That car Wayne built, he called the Transit 2. Not a sexy name, a practical name. When Wayne took it out on this cross-country race he was telling me about earlier, he was sponsored by the car rental company Avis.
When we got to California, since we had gone in on the project with Avis, Avis wanted us to take the car on the way back, stop at all a whole bunch of cities, you know, go to Denver, Salt Lake City, everything else, and pull up at the Avis offices, and then they would have, like, demonstrations, take people for a ride, that type of thing. People would get totally turned on by it. And especially, you know, the vehicle had excellent performance, acceleration. They just loved it.
Tell me, though, about the kind of media attention that you were getting. I mean, Time Magazine, were people hunting you down and doing features about this new electric car? This is 1971. I need to keep reminding myself of that.
We had a tremendous amount of press all the way across country. In fact, one of the students that I had used in the race, I hired him full-time, and I said, all right, you want some responsibility? Here's the car. Take it around the country, and I'll see you in a couple months. And he called me up one day, and he said, I called up the TV station, and they weren't interested in coming out. I said, just go park the car in front of the TV station. Don't call them up. Just park the car in front. Then he called me back, and he said, you couldn't believe it. You know, everybody in front of the TV station was intrigued with the car, and I'm giving rides. And finally, they came out, and they did a big program on the car.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. of Wayne Goldman's electric car and what he thought in the early 70s was his next move into manufacturing. He and the president of the company he worked for were convinced that consumers were ready to buy electric cars of their own. Meanwhile, Wayne was using the little two-seater he built for his own commute, 25, 30 miles a day, and he was thinking through its limitations and ways to make it work better.
When you have the charged batteries, you actually only have, say, the equivalent of 2 gallons of gas of energy in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you got 2 gallons of gas in your vehicle, are you going to go 75 miles an hour or are you going to go 40 miles an hour? So when I started going to work, I'd take the highway where I was going about 60 miles an hour, and I said, this is not practical, because where the electric car is really practical is into urban driving. So I ended up going through town. By going the back way, the vehicle was entirely practical.
And it was street legal at that point. You had no trouble getting a license for it?
No problem. In fact, the license plate was Watts. No, there was no problem at all. I mean, the vehicle was entirely satisfactory.
And how was it in snow? Did you run it in the wintertime as well?
Ran it in the wintertime. I can't believe I did this. After we built the vehicle, I rented a racetrack in Connecticut for a week, and we went down there, and all we did was taking the type of testing where you accelerate to say 40 miles an hour for X number of seconds,
right,
and then deaccelerate, stop and go driving to see what was the actual range and how the energy was being consumed in the vehicle.
What was the commute like? Did you look forward to your drive to work each morning?
Yeah, it was fascinating. It really was, because, again, the car attracted so much attention. And I think it was Popular Science came out and they put the car on the cover of the magazine and did an article on it. We got a tremendous amount of press. CBS News, Walter Cronkite, they interviewed me, that type of thing. From there, I got contacted by the post office, and they said, we're interested in having you develop for us an electric delivery van.
This was your breakthrough moment.
This was a breakthrough moment. And when I went to the post office, they wanted a vehicle to replace the Jeep. And one of the big advantages was I think the Jeep had a center of gravity like 30-odd inches. It was an extremely awkward vehicle, and it would tip over, and you really couldn't see where you were going. So I was able to just say, we can do this, we can do that, and what we'd like to do is go to the post offices and talk to the guys who are driving the vehicles to find out what they like and what they don't like in the current vehicles.
I mean, it sounds perfect. Why isn't my mail today being delivered by an electric vehicle like the one that you're describing?
When we started dealing with the post office, we built a vehicle for them. It went through 3 months of testing for everything from bumper impact to all the conditions they wanted done.
And they're happy with it?
And they're happy. And then we put it in service in Lowell, Massachusetts. And they used to do, I think it was 325 deliveries a day over like a 15 to 20 mile distance. And the guy who drove it loved it. The post office then decided they wanted a quotation for 250 vehicles. But the procurement department said, look, we'll buy electric vehicles when Jeep makes them. We don't want to start with a small company that's getting going and everything else. We want to buy them from our current supplier.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. At the time that Wayne Goldman was negotiating his way through the post office procurement bureaucracy, he was also talking to other big investors, like Exxon.
They were in the energy business, and they didn't care whether the energy was electric power for vehicles or solar. They had invested in our company and also a solar cell company. But the problem was that everyone saw the electric car as not being a specialty item, but to be a direct competitor for the internal combustion vehicle. Those 10 million cars and trucks sold every year. And what happened is as we started putting vehicles out and setting up dealers and everything else, We had no problem doing that. But the feedback that I was getting is that consumers really didn't want a limited mileage vehicle. But I was getting input from commercial companies for delivery within the cities, a lot of interest from the airports, you know, for baggage handling vehicles. But Exxon didn't want to go in the commercial vehicle market because that wasn't 10 million cars and trucks being sold every year.
But still, you covered a lot of ground to get to that point of, setting up for commercial production and contemplating dealerships. I mean, that's further down the road of electric car manufacture than anybody is even today. And we're talking about 35 years ago.
That's right. And what was interesting is at the last minute, they pulled out. Exxon said, we no longer want to be in this business. We had $1 million in orders on the books, and we lost that.
What happened, though, to the prospect of a consumer market? I mean, after Exxon pulled the plug, did you have any hope of trying to get more cars out there and get people interested in them?
Well, I tried an experiment. Before Exxon pulled out, I called in my sales manager, and I said, look, I want to know why the dealers aren't reordering. I said, I don't know whether it's price or it's limited performance. So just for the heck of it, call 3 dealers and tell them to cut the price in half. So at that time, we were selling a vehicle for $8,500.
And just so for comparison purposes, what would I have been paying for a baseline Ford at that point?
Half that price. So I said, you know, tell them to put a price of $4,500. So it's the same price as an internal combustion vehicle. So we cut the price on 3 vehicles, and it didn't sell. And I said, okay, it's obvious. We're not ready yet for a consumer market. The market is for the industrial-type product, and then the consumer product will come later on.
But with Exxon out of the picture, did you have the capacity to start producing vehicles for, you know, airports, coal mines?
No, that was the problem, because when Exxon pulled out, we basically only lasted a short period of time, and it was during the economic crunch. I think it was around 75 at the time, and we couldn't turn it around. I basically continued to do R&D. I bought some of the assets of the company, and I continued to do development work in electric vehicles for another 5 years.
Did you ever make any money at this, Wayne?
Not really.
Did you lose money?
Not really. But, I mean, I had a great time.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. So what does Wayne Goldman think now when he reads in the news that Chevy and other companies are just on the cusp of rolling out a new line of electric cars? And they're saying that they'll do it as soon as they have the battery power fixed. Wayne smiles and says to consumers, don't hold your breath.
No company is going to go out and make a major investment to develop batteries for electric vehicles because they wouldn't see a payback in probably 5 years after development. What is going to drive battery development is the fact that there's a market for them. So the whole concept would be to get the electric vehicles out there with lead-acid batteries, which have been used for 100 years, and they're predictable and they're economical. And then people will see that the market for a developed battery is worth the investment, because you could start putting them in the vehicles right away. We sort of use the excuse, we're waiting for the better battery.
So you say this excuse, because, you know, Chevy's using that with its new Volt, and other people are saying, oh, we don't have the battery just right yet. You're saying this is bogus, that they should just get the car on the road, and then the battery design will naturally follow.
But you have to remember, you can't sell it to replace the conventional car. So if you went out there and said, okay, we want to meet people who are commuting, say, total of 30 miles a day, who want a vehicle which is silent, which is not going to use any energy, it's a perfect application.
You think you're going to see these cars on the market, on the streets?
Not when you have companies making electric cars for $100,000 that'll go 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. I mean, when you, again, you've got the equivalent of 2 gallons of gas on board. And so you have to find someone who realizes that and is willing to accept the reduction in performance. But if you try to make an electric like every other car on the road, if you make an electric that goes 65, 70 miles an hour, it's not going to be effective. You have to accept it for the use function. If your duty cycle is commuting to work, 40 miles an hour through the city, it's perfect.
Wayne Goldman lives in Elmore, Vermont. Now, I knew something about the history of electric cars, but I didn't know anything about Wayne. He wrote in with his story, and you can do exactly the same thing if you're living out a story you'd like to talk with me about. Just send me a couple of lines. You can go to our website. It's the fastest way to get to me. By the way, when you're there, we have pictures of the car, the Transit 2, and Wayne Goldman on our website. It's all at thestory.org. Up next, another story for you of someone who had a dream and did something about it. In this case, it's about running away to join the circus, and there's a car angle as well. For example, ever wonder how they get all those clowns in that tiny car?
They lay them all down. I mean, there's no trap door. They are all squeezed in there, and it's usually the first year clowns because the ones that have the seniority know they don't have to do it.
They don't have to do the car squishing thing, right?
That's right.
For Deborah Lusk, the Big Top was her way out of Texas, a way to see the country, to travel. Oh, and to ride an elephant wearing a bubble skirt. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I never really seriously thought of running away to join the circus. That's probably because what passed for circuses in my hometown were kind of straggly affairs. The Fall Fair in Port Hope was more about the 4-H than the Barnum and the Bailey. But as a boy, I loved to read the stories about people who ran away to join the circus. And Deborah Lusk did it. When she was in her early 20s, she was living in the Houston area, working as a bank teller, and thinking that she'd never really been very far away from home.
But the one thing I'd always wanted to do was travel. I'd never really had the opportunity to do that and always wanted to. I had some dance background from high school, and I just kept thinking to myself, I could do that. And wow, wouldn't that be fun to travel around with the show, getting to see all these cities?
Now, you could have just bought one of these 30-day bus passes and gone right around the United States. You didn't have to join the circus, Deborah.
I really enjoyed the performance part of it, too.
You like the idea of being a showgirl up on one of those elephants, right?
Yes, yes. That was such a thrill.
Okay, well, you did something that most of us dream of and almost none of us do. So how easy was it to actually run away and join the circus?
There was an audition that I had to go through in Houston. And there were about a dozen of us, and we were working with the dance captain and working in front of the choreographer, and they basically showed us some steps, and they wanted to see how fast we could pick up the moves, you know, how we could work together. Did we smile?
So you had this dance background from high school, but you knew in the audition that it wasn't a dance you were just going to do on the ground, that you were going to be dancing on the back of an elephant. You knew that, right?
Well, I think the best advice that I got prior to the audition was to at least try to do anything they might ask us to do, because on one of the shows, the showgirls also go up on the ropes and they hang, you know, they're twirled, they hang from their feet or from their wrist. And they said, you know, if they ask you during the audition to climb a rope, at least be ready to do that. Or if they ask you to do a cartwheel or a can-can, at least try.
So did they put you through any unusual paces at the audition?
No. It was all straight dance maneuvers. It was all terminology that I had heard before. So it really wasn't anything particularly difficult. It was just picking up these lines of dancing and how quickly to do that. And they picked three of us that day for additional photographs and interviews. So I knew that I had made some sort of cut.
Okay, now I have to ask you, at what point did you decide to tell family and friends? Because you could go to the audition and not tell anybody.
Correct. Well, the bad part about that was I didn't tell anyone, and then it was on the 6 p.m. news.
Oh, no.
So I kept hoping my boss from the bank didn't see that because I was, of course, out sick, quote unquote.
But you mean the audition was on the news?
Yes. Yes, the audition was on the news. They actually interviewed the three of us that made this cut. So,
and you'd booked off sick from the bank that day.
Yes. As it turns out, my employer just thought it was a hoot too. So I didn't have any repercussions.
What about family and friends? Did anybody think that what you were doing was just nuts?
If they had misgivings, they did a great job keeping it to themselves. I never got any negative feedback. And of course, the first person I called was my mom. Bless her heart. I know that had to have been a real mixed feeling because she knew how happy I was. And yet I'm sure she was not particularly happy.
It's funny, you know, Deborah, because that old idea of running away to join the circus, the first part of it is, wouldn't it be fun? The second part of it is, oh, no, you shouldn't go because the circus people, they're all big, roughneck, animal training, you know, sledgehammer wielding toughs, and it's no place for a young woman. I mean, nobody was giving you that kind of feedback, were they?
No, but it's interesting that you make that characterization because there were certain towns that we'd go to where the buildings would actually go out of their way to lock up their extra chairs and their extra toilet paper and any supplies that might be lying around.
Those circus thugs, you can't trust them.
Exactly.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story about Deborah Lusk's decision to run away and join the circus. Deborah was hired for her dancing skills. She was hired to work as a circus showgirl, but what would that mean exactly?
The taller girls were the ones that they would leave on the ground typically to wear the more statuesque costumes.
Yeah.
And the shorter girls, like myself, I'm 5'3", we would be the ones put on the elephants.
And what was your thinking when you found out you were going to be one of the ones on the elephants?
Oh, I was thrilled. I was just hoping that I would get to.
Okay.
But I vividly remember the first day going out to the paddock with the elephants and the trainer. His nickname was Buckles, and Buckles was a huge man, well over 6 feet, probably mid-200 pounds, and he showed us how he could hang off the ear of this elephant completely off the ground, and she would just stand there with no expression whatsoever to let us know that when we mounted the elephant, we were going to have to hold on to the ear and it wasn't going to hurt the elephant.
And did he have you mounting the elephants that first day?
Yes. They have to get you on quickly because that's a big part of the choreography. You have to get used to how the elephant moves. Mine actually had an arthritic hip, and so she had more of a, well, here in Texas they say a hitch in her giddy-up. And so she,
I got you.
She had an abnormal walk, and it made it a little bit trickier to stay on her. So we have to get used to that before you then turn around and try and do that when you're in costume.
So see if you can describe this for me. The ear of the elephant is low enough that you can stand on the ground and grab it. Is that right?
Right. What happens is the trainer comes up to the head of the elephant and has it lower its head. So it bends its head down, and at the same time, it bends the knee of its front leg on the same side. So you grab the elephant's ear with both hands, you put your left foot up on the leg, and you hold on because the trainer says lift, and the elephant literally tosses you up onto its neck.
Is it as easy as it sounds?
It's a smooth motion, but if you don't have a good grip on the elephant's ear, it can toss you up over and beyond, so you can literally go flying off into the distance.
That ever happened to you?
No, I'm happy to say it did not.
Deborah Lusk was in her early 20s when she dropped everything, quit her job, put all her belongings in storage, and spent 2 years on the road with the circus. Her living quarters on the circus train were limited.
I had a compartment that was 4 feet wide by 6 feet long.
Wait a second. That's the size of a closet.
Pretty much. And it had a bed and one of those small refrigerators. And I had a crock pot and a hot plate and a mirror on one wall and a big window. And that was really it.
So you could actually, you could watch the country going by as you went from city to city?
Oh, yes. Oh, and it was wonderful. You know, the show would close on Sunday night. We'd go back to the train and usually party because you didn't have to do anything. And then you go to bed, and at some time around 3 or 4 in the morning, the train would leave, and you'd wake up and you'd be on the road to somewhere else.
Did it give you the kind of travel that you'd hoped that it would?
Yes, absolutely. We started in Florida. We went straight up the East Coast. The first year that I was there, we covered 49 cities in 42 weeks. And so we went to very small towns that I'm sure I wouldn't have seen otherwise. And then we went to the major cities as far north as Seattle, Washington. When we were on the East Coast, we went as far north as Portland, Maine. And virtually everywhere you can think of in between, the one major city that we never went to was Las Vegas, interestingly enough.
Maybe because the whole place is already a circus. Right?
Possibly. Possibly.
So what was the work like? Was it tough?
Once we had the choreography down, no, it really wasn't hard. We were in four production numbers, and each number was perhaps 5-10 minutes long at the most. And then you're backstage for 45 minutes just playing cards, playing backgammon, listening to the music, waiting until your cue to go back and get in your next costume for the next number.
And what are you wearing, Deborah?
The costumes for the show were all hand-sewn. There was nothing plastic on them. It was all glass or metal-type jewels and beading and what have you, and elaborate headpieces. And each show had a theme, so that, for instance, my second year, it was Circus in Space. And so everything, all the numbers had a space-type theme and coordinating costumes.
How do you dress a showgirl for outer space?
They actually made these metallic-looking costumes. It was a fitted leotard, but it had wings that were on a harness that we had to put on separately, sort of a bubble-like skirt. It was a clear plastic, almost like a half a bubble skirt, which they had to get rid of because we couldn't get up on the elephants wearing them. And that happened a fair amount of the time. The costume designers would design the costumes based on the theme, but then we'd actually get into dress rehearsals, and either the choreography couldn't be done with the costume as it was, or we couldn't mount the elephants, so they'd have to make adjustments during rehearsals.
Were the costumes heavy?
I know my first year that was supposed to be like an Arabian Nights number where we had these skirts that really needed to twirl. So they had a lead tubing at the bottom of the skirt that you would twirl in. And then the headpiece itself was about 5 pounds. And yeah, you'd have to run. A lot of times you'd be running along the track in front of the elephants. So you definitely had to get out of the way. And then some costumes were designed to look heavy, but they actually weren't. There was a Caribbean number one year where we had an extremely tall headpiece. It was about 3 feet tall, but it was all ostrich feathers that were very, very light. So it wasn't hard to maneuver in at all.
And were you ever hurt? Did you ever get stepped on by your elephant?
I never got hurt by any of the animals. I did have a muscle tear that happened during one of the performances, but that's really minor compared to the potential things that can happen. We actually had one aerial act, a husband and wife, that fell during a performance, and they performed without a net. So they fell right to the concrete flooring beneath. We also had one performer who was killed during rehearsal, who was a flyer, being a trapeze artist, and he was only 15. And when we get into a new city, each city, the flyers would set up their own rigging, and they would practice, usually around 10 or 11 at night. And in this particular case, they were working on a 3.5 somersault. That was really something special, and the boy was working with a net and with a safety belt, a thick leather belt around his waist that's buckled in and has two ropes on either side of it that go down and are held by people on the ground.
Yeah.
And so there's no catcher. They're just simply working on release, spin, open up, and then go into the net. But what happened was when he opened up, his belt broke. A very freak accident, and the force of his revolutions spun him out away from the net. So while that would normally be plenty of protection, he was killed. So there is a certain amount of danger in the circus.
Were you there when that happened, Evan?
I was not in the building, but of course we all knew about it, and we all made the decision to go on with the performance and interestingly endured a rather scathing editorial from the local paper for doing so.
The local paper thought that you should cancel your performance out of respect?
That's right.
You know, I can imagine, or I think I can imagine, what it might be like to be in the audience when one of these death-defying acts, actually something goes wrong in it. But what's it like among circus performers when something like that happens?
It's exactly how I would imagine if something would happen to a family member. If you get that call that you dread from the police or from the hospital. Because we were all such a close family, many of these performers were literally families. You'd have several generations in the same family that were there, and you just were very close to them. I mean, we would travel for so many weeks together, and you live together, and you work together, and you do everything. And so it was very, very hard.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Deborah Lusk traveled to most major cities in the U.S. in her 2 years with the circus. She says most of the time it was fun, even glamorous, so much so that it was hard for her to leave.
Once I left the show, it was such an insular place that I had just terrible withdrawal. And almost daily, for the first 2 months I was back in Houston, I would want to pick up the phone to call the producer to tell them I'd made a horrible mistake and could I please come back?
You'd already run away to the circus once. Why didn't you just do it a second time?
Well, I came back home to get back on the path to medical school. That was also a worthwhile endeavor.
When you left the circus, what did you miss?
When you have just a small room on a train, it's your nest. I just missed that. And it was very structured. I knew exactly what I was going to be doing 5 to 6 days out of every week. I had a schedule. I knew exactly what cities I was going to be in any given day of the year. And all of that structure, it's very comforting. And then you come
back.
Someone
else is making the decisions, right?
Exactly, exactly.
And once you stopped your circus life and had a chance to reflect back on it, did it change you in any way?
Very much so, very profoundly, I think, because I'd had 2 years of not only being exposed to all the different cities in this nation, but I was working with people from all over the world. There were more than a few of them that were probably running from the past they'd rather forget, or they have, you know, records. And so it was being exposed to quite a different slice of life than I'd ever had.
So now I'm imagining you late some Tuesday night in some city somewhere talking about Bulgarian politics with some trapeze artist from Eastern Europe.
That's exactly what it was. In fact, I was on the show when America beat Russia in ice hockey in the Olympics. And that was a major source of pride for the Americans on the show and just almost chagrin for the Eastern Europeans that were there. And that was a big blow to them.
Do you think that after your 2 years in the circus, you were more confident, more willing to take chances, do things that you wouldn't have done before that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I came back more excited about not just staying in the same little safe lifestyle that I had before I left.
And you're a mother now, right?
Yes, yes. I have a 17-year-old daughter.
I mean, you speak so glowingly of your circus terms. I wonder what you'd say if she told you, Mom, I'm running away to go to the circus.
Well, I've actually thought about that myself. And I think that the best thing I could do for her would be to give her the same space that my parents gave me. I think it's the best possible thing to do, because you won't know if you don't try.
Deborah Lusk talked with me from Beaumont, Texas. We have some photos of Deborah on our website at thestory.org. There she is in her full showgirl regalia. There's a lot of weight in those costumes. So what was your dream? Did you take that chance that Deborah did? Did it make a difference? Or did you choose not to follow that one dream that you had and think back on that? If you have a story about following a dream or wishing that you had, let me know. Go to our website at thestory.org, or you can leave me a message on our phone line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.